Named Ali in honor of his grandfather, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, on growing up, he acquired the epithet of Zainul Abidin, or Ornament of the Pious, because his proverbial piety, power of prayers, patience, prudence, and prostrations to the Almighty Creator. He was also known as Ibnul Khiyaratain, or the son of two virtuous persons, in view of the fact that his father was the Prophet's grandson, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, the chief of martyrs and the leader of the youths of paradise, while his mother was the chaste princess of Persia, Shahrbanu, peace upon her, also known as the Sayyid al-Sajidin, or simply Imam Sajjad, for his lengthy hours of prostration to God Almighty, he needs no introduction, even to non-Muslims, thanks to the two universally acknowledged works bequeathed by him to mankind. The first is Sahifat al-Sajjadiyyah, which is a collection of his supplications to God that range from the bounties of the Lord Most High to the matters of mundane life, including such wonders of the world of science as the weight of light, something that was beyond the ken of mankind in his days. The second is the Risalat al-Huquq, or Treatise of Rights, from which the rights of the tongue have been mentioned at the head of his brief newspaper column. It is a work that he dedicated to one of his disciples to expound every minute right of a human being in society, including a person's own physical organs that are nothing but divine trust, to see how one uses or misuses them. No wonder this treatise has been hailed as more comprehensive and perfect than the so-called Human Rights Declaration of the United Nations, which is full of flaws. It would be repetitive to recount the tragedy of Karbala, how patiently Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, endured it, how he was subjected to imprisonment, how he was dragged to the courts of the tyrants in Kufa and Damascus, and how he shook the foundations of Yazid's illegal rule by using his tongue to proclaim the victory of his martyred father's mission and to expose as a heathen the self-styled caliph. It is also not possible to go into details on the glorious events of his 34-year imamat, during which he ably guided the Ummah in the turbulent era of six Umayyad tyrants and the usurper in Hejaz, Abdullah ibn Zubayr, all of whom, like their courtiers, misused the tongue to indulge in lies, deceit, sedition, blasphemy, bloodshed, and every abominable utterance except for expressing the truth. Thus, in view of these undeniable facts, in today's morally bankrupt world, we who claim to be followers of Prophet of Islam's Immaculate Ahlul Bayt owe not to emulate the enemies of humanity and cause dissension in society. It is incumbent upon us to heed the call of Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, to human beings to have proper control of their tongue and observe its rights, for if not properly used, the tongue will complain to God Almighty on the Day of Judgment about the violation of its rights by the owner. Both good and evil are spread by the tongue. It means the tongue is the real barometer for measuring the personality of a person, and not confined to casual talk and mere taste of foods and drinks to satisfy one's gluttonous appetite. True, With the help of this sensitive organ, one can understand the sweetness, bitterness, sourness, and saltiness of foods. But the fourth imam stresses on how to use it properly, since the tongue is vital for conveying our concepts and ideas, as well as promoting peace, understanding, prosperity, and perfection in the family, in the society, and among mankind. In other words, the brain or the intellect, which is indeed a treasure trove and distinguishes human beings from other species, depends on the tongue for its proper unraveling. And if we were to use our tongue to spread doubts, uncertainty, sedition, immorality, etc. in society to undermine the truth and to distort realities, then we certainly do not deserve to be called the true followers of Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him. To be brief, the fourth Imam, who was famous for his piety, patience, and prudence, was a picture of courtesy towards all sections of the society, always willing to forgive the faults of even those who had wronged him. His legacy is very much alive today and serves as ethical examples emulated by all, whether laymen or scholars who have written volumes on his exemplary life and commentaries on his treatises. To end our radio program, here is a beautiful statement of thanksgiving from Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him. My God, my thanksgiving is small before your great boons, and my praise and proclaiming of it shrink beside your generosity toward me. Your favors have wrapped me in the robes of the lights of faith, and the gentleness of your goodness have let down over me delicate curtains of might. Your kindnesses have colored me with colors not to be removed, and adorned me with neck rings not to be broken. Your boons are abundant, my tongue is too weak to count them. Your favors are many, my understanding falls short of grasping them, not to speak of exhausting them. So, how can I complete thanksgiving? For my thanksgiving, you requires thanksgiving. Whenever I say, to you belongs praise, it thereby becomes incumbent upon me to say, to you belongs praise. My God, as you have fed us through your gentleness and nurtured us through your benefaction, so also complete for us lavish favors, repel from us detested acts of vengeance and of the shares of the two abodes, the world and the afterlife. Give us their most elevated and their greatest, both the immediate and the deferred. O Almighty, O All Generous, by your mercy, O Most Merciful of the Merciful.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities. where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then send our congratulatory messages to our 12th and living Imam, Al-Hujja Ajalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif, and to each and every one of you as we gather on this evening to celebrate the birth anniversary of our fourth Imam, Imam Zainul Abideen As-Sajjad, Alayhima Afdalu Salatu Wassalam. Amma salli ala Muhammadin wa Ali Muhammad. We pray to Allah Azza wa Jal that we each get an opportunity to go for the ziyarat of our Imam to Baqi, and that we receive his shafaat in the hereafter, inshaAllah. The fourth Imam As-Sajjad alayhi afdalu salatu wassalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa Ali Muhammad. There was a person around him, qala bi hadratihi rajulun. That a person who was around him said the following, he uttered it. He said, Allahumma aghnini an khalqik. Yeah, that, O Allah, make me needless of your creation. Yeah, that I don't need anybody. Just make me free. And this is sometimes a thought that we have, you know. Okay, don't make me majboor. You know, when we get old, what we don't want is to be dependent upon people. We would rather be able to take care of ourselves, and that's an understanding that we have. But when the Imam alayhi salam heard him say this, you know, أَغْنِنِي عَنْ خَلْقِكْ, like make me needless of your creation, the Imam says, لَيْسَ هَكَذَا. He says, don't say it like this. Yeah, he says, إِنَّمَا النَّاسُ بِالنَّاسِ. He says, because people need people. Yeah, people are in service of people. He says, وَلَكِنْ قُلْ اللَّهُمَّ أَغْنِنِي عَنْ شِرَارِ خَلْقِكْ. That, O Allah, make me free of the worst of your creation. Yeah, make me needless of the worst of your creation. And this, you know, I found this tradition important, right? I found it fascinating in one hand, but I found it important as well, because I think sometimes we find ourselves in the polar extreme of these things, you know? Like when I see children want to be independent. Very quickly. They don't want help from anybody, especially their parents, you know. They know math better than us. They know English better than us. They know life better than us. And so they think they don't need advice from us at all, you know. And it's this independence that they have when they're young that makes them feel as though they can function without other people. I don't care what other people have to think about me. This is an idea that's there in many of our kids, you know. And maybe we went through it. Not maybe, I'm sure we went through it. We just don't remember because we were all angels, alhamdulillah, you know. And then when we get a little bit older, what we find is that we begin to be easily influenced by other people. So as we hit our older age, what we find is that we have a desire for the approval of people. Yeah, and we want to see what others think about us, and we want to make others happy. And so our entire paradigm shifts to now, instead of not wanting anyone, I want to make everyone happy. And so what you find is a lot of hypocrisy that exists within us, where we find ourselves torn between the values of Islam and the values of the world that we live in, because we want to fit in so desperately. And so again, we find another polar extreme that takes place. And then as we get much older than that, you know, we once again become very secretive and isolated. Yeah? As if I can handle the world's problems myself, you know. And this is an unfortunate reality, you know. There are oftentimes, you know, people who get sick in our community. And I would love nothing more, and I'm sure all of us would love nothing more than to go visit them and comfort them. But they want to hide their illness, as if it's some type of bala from God. It's not. It's an illness, you know. And then you hear about it from a third person, but they say, shh, don't tell them, don't call him, they don't want anyone to know. And you're like, Baba, why? What's the secretiveness? We need each other. We need each other. We need each other for dua. Yeah, we need each other for happiness. We need each other to make life better. And this is where you find, you know, that it's in between these polar extremes that a balance has to be struck of interaction of life. Yeah, the fact is, we need each other. Yeah, we need each other on so many different levels. You know, we need each other to help find us a job. We need each other for du'as when we are sick. You know, I was trying to... there are some people who are very, mashallah, like self-to-do in our communities, you know. So I was thinking that maybe we need accountants, and then somebody would be like, I do my own taxes. Yeah, and then I say, yeah, but you need a car mechanic. He's like, I change my own oil, you know. I was like, Baba, but you need a farmer to grow your food. And this is where you're like, you're right, you know. I can't grow my own food the way they do. I can't slaughter a cow the way the others do. We need each other. Yeah, whether we realize it or not, we are constantly needful of each other. And this is one reality. And the second part of that needing each other is that we also need each other for our success in Akhirah. You understand? Because my success in Akhirah is not just dependent upon me praying salah and fasting, but my success in Akhirah is dependent on how well I looked after the needs of the creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But we need the help of each other to make that happen. If I am secretive, you are secretive, I don't have a chance to help you, you don't have a chance of helping me. And so what we see is that we have to learn this balance of where we can reach out to each other, be connected with each other. But the trick of that balance is to ensure that the people that we keep around us are not toxic people. That's what the Imam was saying. That seek the protection of God from the worst of creation. Those who just want to manipulate us. Those who want to find our faults. Those who want to point out our mistakes. Because in their pointing out our mistakes, they feel a sense of pride. As if they've done something. As if my happiness is affecting their happiness. Why should it? Yeah, be happy, I'm happy. Let's all be happy. Right? But it's that balance that we have to find. And once we find that balance, there is this beautiful hadith, you know. What the Imam alayhi salam, again, is from our fourth Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam. Salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. He says that we need each other. But at the same time, he cautions us that even though we need each other, we should be very careful not to ask for things that we don't need from each other. You understand? Again, there's a difference. Because the moment I need you, and shaitan will say, ah, just call him, he'll do it for you. Yeah? Just call him, he'll pick this up for you. Just call him. Imam says, don't reach out to each other for things that you can do yourself. Yeah? Don't reach out to others for things that you can do while struggling for it. That means as soon as a little hardship hits, you don't run around crying to people. Yeah, you can tell someone, make dua for me. Yes, tell someone, make dua for me. Yeah, we're all needy of dua. But the Imam says the following. He says, "Dhamintu ala Rabbi." He says, I assure you by my Lord, "An la yas'ala ahadun ahada min ghairi hajatin illa tarrattuhu hajata bil mas'ala." He says that do not ask others unnecessarily until and unless you are compelled to ask for your needs and then ask someone to help fulfill it. That means until you reach that breaking point, then you reach out to someone to say, hey, I need a little bit of help right now financially. Hey, I need a little bit of help with this. But until then, struggle. But that struggle doesn't mean that we don't use each other for our assistance. We help each other. And it's a balance, yeah? This is what I said, this is a balance. Where that balance lies is the trick of life. Find it, yeah? Find it. Find it where we realize that my trust is only in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but the function of life requires that we are with each other, and this is why this community is so important. Let's reflect on this tradition, about that balancing act. Because once we learn how to balance, life becomes a whole lot easier, inshallah.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود
قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Dear ladies from all around the world, welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Muslim lady. Well, this is Asma. You're listening to Arab English Radio and I'm honored to be your host. Here with us, we have Brother Mustafa, who is going to help us know more about issues related to Muslim ladies.
Right.
Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me. Really happy to be here to speak about, you know, these topics. Definitely, it's, you know, a bit of a surprise or a shock to be invited to talk about this topic, considering I'm a man. However, I am studying psychology in the Hawza. You know, I'm married with kids, so have a lot of experience, I would say, that I can hopefully share and give maybe an insight or perspective from the outside.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So, as we can see right now in today's life, there are a lot of things that are going differently if we are going to compare them with the past. And one of those things is the appearance of the society. It has been changed totally. The way women and men are going to define themselves has been changed. And there are a lot of reasons for that. So if we want to put a label for today's discussion, we're going to put it this way, that what are the challenges a woman, a lady, would face in today's world?
Yeah, I think today's world is a very, very difficult place, you know, for anyone, especially for women, I would say, and mothers. A lot of that, of course, has to do with, for example, the westernization of the world, right?
Or
and part of that is, of course, this feminist movement, right? That's really changed how women perceive themselves, mm-hmm. right? You know, from a psychological point of view, when we talk about this, we say that someone's understanding of a certain topic, you know, how they perceive that topic is really important. If they have the wrong perception about any topic, then they're going to, you know, maybe not interact with that, you know, in a better way. To give you sort of an example of what I mean, what I'm talking about is someone's attitude, right? An attitude towards something is made up of three components, right? Mm-hmm. One is their sort of understanding of that. I'll take something very simple. Let's say it's a snake, right? So what you understand from a snake, you understand it's an animal, for example, that is dangerous.
It's poisonous.
It's poisonous. And then to that, you have an emotional reaction to that, mm-hmm. right? And once you have it could be fear, it could be curiosity. Some people love snakes, right?
Yeah.
And that then impacts your behavior, right? So these three components are important. And I would say the attitude that's given towards mothers and women, that's really changed, right? People don't necessarily recognize how important that is. For example, women are defined as a working person, you know, just like a man, for example. So if you get that perception in your mind and you have that emotional reaction, that's going to change your behavior.
Exactly. Now, we have it that in literature, we call it ideology. As we go through critical concepts, we call that ideology. Society usually creates ideology based on their benefit, their own right. benefit. They're going to create a special ideologies, and then they would impose it on the mind of other people. So what happens is that, just like the way that you mentioned, if I am settled with this idea that a woman is as equal as a man in her abilities, in her power, let's say, not abilities, because all the women out there are so creative, they have a lot of abilities and talents, but you don't necessarily have to get outside the I don't want to say home, because even there are women who are working outside and they're making a balance between what right. what they're doing outside and what the responsibilities they have at home. But I'm just saying that when society tells you that you must work as a laborer just like a man, and you come to believe it, then everything is going to be changed.
And the you know, that causes like the family unit to be destroyed, right?
Yeah.
When the mother isn't playing her role, for example, to the best extent possible, then that's going to have an impact on the family.
And right? that's why we get to individualism. Now people tend to be living all alone.
Right. And one thing that I learned recently, you know, that compared to the past and to now, for example, the way advertisements and the media works, right?
Mm-hmm. I guess this is the best time for us to go for a short break, a change of mood, and then we'll be back to see what's going on. Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady, and we're talking about the challenges a woman would face in today's life, which is very difficult world. We already mentioned some points related to ideology and how society is going to impose its own ideology and its own way of thinking upon the minds of the individuals in society. And how, if you accept that, okay, a woman is equal to a man, though she's not, because she's more delicate, she does not have that much of power to go for difficult jobs. Yet, if you believe it, then you are going to accept all the social norms that are so right. prevailing right now. And then, at the same time, society would go through the pathway of individualism. That is, nobody would like to interact with other people. All that matters is that I am living alone, doing my own job, and I'm a social being.
Yeah, and
like
that. To be honest with you, that sounds kind of depressing. And
a lot. That's very
And I
depressing.
Know people or examples of, you know, people that are living in different countries, that they're living that life, you know, they're living alone and they're not very happy many times, you mm-hmm. know, especially as they start aging, you know, I once met a relative of ours that lives in Australia, and, you know, she lives by herself. She's probably in her 60s now.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
And like she doesn't have an easy life, I would say.
Of course.
She has a difficult life. And before we went for the break, you know, one of the things that I wanted to mention is that the critical role that today's media plays in this, one of our teachers was explaining this. He was saying that in the past, you know, you didn't have as much advertisement. You didn't have as much you know, means of getting information.
Commercials.
And not only that, like, let's say we didn't have, like, individual phones, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Right now, whatever I'm viewing right now in this room, you know, on my phone, for example, you're not aware of it.
Yeah.
Right? So the channel that we're getting information from becomes secret. It's anonymous from like, the other family members. So you find this example in one home, there's going to be, like, five people, and all five people have different ideologies because of how they're using media yeah. and what they're looking up.
And five separate worlds.
It's five separate worlds, right? And that has a huge impact on the on how women perceive their role as mothers or exactly. what their role in society is. And that's what's really causing challenges.
You say as a mother, I would say as a woman. As a woman, it has been changed, much less a mother.
Right. Right. The focus has been, and the other thing that our teacher was mentioning, that unfortunately, women and ladies, they're used as tools for exactly. advertisements, mm-hmm. right? They're used as a tool, not as, like, it's, they're not seen as, like, the final, when you're trying to sell a product, right? You're trying to sell a product to people, right? And they're saying they're using women as a tool to sell products.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. To convince people.
To convince people that, or, you know, to attract people to come and buy that product.
It's actually very paradoxical. Even all these movements that are talking about the rights of women, even the feminists, they all try to talk of women's rights, but what they come up with is actually against women.
Right. And, you know, one of the challenges that occurs in this is that then a woman feels that her role as a mother is not as important.
Exactly.
Right? They lose sight or value of that goal, and they might be, you know, going after, for example, fashion, trying to go after
look. She must be a beautiful doll, and if she has a lot of money, then that would be a perfect lifestyle. Right. Then that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it could be so much more, and you know, women start feeling insecure about their appearance, right? How mm-hmm. they look. And for example, one result of that we're seeing is, for example, plastic surgery.
Yeah.
Right? People are going crazy over there. They're like fixing their nose, their face, their, you know.
Everything.
Yeah. And that is not natural. That is not like something that, you know, that nature, mm-hmm. you'll find in nature. We're the only species, you know, that goes out and changes their appearance.
Yeah.
And it's mostly just a lot of times cosmetic, right? Just exactly. to look good.
So now that you have studied psychology, what are the reasons for that? For that excessive appeal for plastic surgery and changing your nature, your yeah. appearance.
So that is part of, in my opinion, is part of psychological warfare, right?
Yeah.
Psychology as a field of study is unfortunately not always used positively. Mm-hmm. In fact, what you'll find is a lot of the psychological research was done by, for example, the U.S. Army, mm-hmm. you know? So how can they... And from that, we find, for example, many tools and ways that they use to manipulate and control people. In order to sort of weaken society and to weaken the role of a woman, they're using psychological tactics, like I talked about advertisement and, you know,
oh,
media.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
So those are all channels to sort of to change the way you're thinking.
Mentality.
Change your mentality.
Change the values,
your perspective.
Yeah.
Change your attitude. Once you change the attitude towards something and you get that emotional reaction out of someone, it's very easy to change their behavior.
Yeah. Well, I guess right now we have to go for a break and then we'd come back with the last part of today's episode.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So you were just saying that psychology has been used sometimes as a tool against human beings, and especially since we're talking to ladies, against ladies and how they think and change their values and whatsoever. So how we could fight that back?
So the way to fight that back is to correct your attitude, is to correct your understanding of yourself and your relationship with the world.
You have to filter it, I guess, through your values, through your religious norms.
The other thing that I think media does is even they portray that from an Islamic point of view, they portray as if Islam is oppressing women, right? You hear that all the time in Western media.
While on the contrary, Islam is actually being the religion who's been giving yeah. women the freedom, who's been giving women the values.
It's funny that before, you know, I'm living here in Iran and, you know, when I go to other countries, especially where there's Western audiences, they always think that women in Iran are so oppressed, you know,
yeah.
like they don't have freedom. I tell them there's more women working here than there are probably men. You know, their women have way more respect here and way more power here than I would say men have, right? I don't think this is the right thing, but you'll see that right now, these days, even you have female drivers, you know, that
yes.
are picking and
actually,
dropping.
It's good for the safety of women, you know.
It is, but I'm saying I've been like picked up through like, you know, the Snap type services by women as well. So
that's how much freedom they have.
That's how much freedom and lack of oppression they have here, you know, in every bank, in every shop, everywhere you go, you'll find that, you know, women are part of the workforce here.
And speaking of religion, I would say that in the Holy Book of Quran, we have a chapter devoted to women. That means all the important matters of women do matter in our religion.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, our religion, the way Islam honors a woman and a lady and a mother, for example, it's you will not find it in any other religion or ideology,
mm-hmm.
right? In fact, we find that many times people that convert to Islam, any woman that converted, is because of this reason.
Exactly. So just to wrap it all up, we would say that there are a lot of challenges that a woman must face in today's world. But the only solution to it is just to revert those psychological tools that you say that are being used in order to change the mentality of women is to think.
It's to think, it's to ponder. And I would say, you know, stop watching like nonsense serials and dramas which fill your mind with like rubbish notions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the other tools, by the way, right?
Okay. And thank you, brother. And thank you, dear listeners, dear ladies, for staying with us. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
It must be heaven.
Part 1.
May 15th, 1948. The last British ship had not yet faded away when Ben-Gurion announced the establishment of so-called State of Israel in a speech broadcast by the media.
For us, it is the most tragic moment in our history. Will be re-established the old United Nations and the mandatory power of England as a free Jewish commonwealth where all inhabitants...
The skirmish began. Arab armies crossed over the borders to reach the battlefield in support of Palestinians. Finally, after a year of conflict on all fronts, they retreated, and contrary to expectations, the ground was prepared for the acceptance of the usurped government in the United Nations. May 15, 1948 became known as Nakba Day. The day when the occupiers finally put their seal on the Holy Land. But the truth of the matter is that Palestine was conquered by Zionist filmmakers for the first time in cinema frames. This documentary is a story of the occupation of Palestine in cinema pictures and the struggle and effort by Palestinian filmmakers to recapture their country through the lens. When the train passed the last curve, the city could be seen in the distance. The inventors of cinema had come to the east. The Lumiere brothers were the first passengers who got off the train at Hahn Station. Pretty soon, the anchorages and the crowded markets, the men scorched under the sun, and ancient shrines moved in front of the camera of the Lumieres. It was the most popular land in the world, the Holy Land, Palestine. For centuries, the most famous warriors in history had drawn their swords in the dream of ruling this land. But from that day, the war was dragged into the cinema frames. After the Lumiere brothers, Christian film production teams arrived one after the other to the land where Jesus Christ was once born, lived, and crucified. When the cameramen were making sneak peeks everywhere to find footprints of Jesus and were presenting a Christian narrative of Palestine, a new rival entered the scene and announced its bid for Palestine. Murray Rosenberg, a Jewish immigrant, made a 20-minute movie named The First Film of Palestine. Undoubtedly, the dream of Israel was born for the first time in this movie with the magic of cinema, and it moved before the greedy eyes of the Zionists. The First World War was devouring and ravaging the world like a monster, but the Zionists were lurking so they might be able to find some booty for themselves from the heart of all the destruction. When the war fronts were tied, the World Zionist Congress made a stunning proposal to the British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George. If Britain undertakes to support the Jewish immigration to Palestine, they will enter the United States into the war. Soon that the Germans, who were supporters of the Ottoman Empire, by sinking the ships belonging to Zionist merchants, forced the U.S. President Woodrow Wilson to enter the battle. A year later, when Allies were at the gates of Al-Quds, Yaakov Ben Dov, a Jewish immigrant who had founded the Menorah Film Company, shot his first film. The movie depicts the historic arrival of General Allenby, the commander of the British Army, in Al-Quds on December 11th, 1917. With the arrival of the Allies in Al-Quds, the 400-year-old reign of the Ottoman Empire on the city ended. Palestine came under the tutelage of Britain, and the Zionist dream finally came true. Only a month before the arrival of the Allies, a statement was issued in which Arthur James Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, announced England's support for establishing a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. In the declaration, which became known as Balfour, London pledged it will provide the necessary means for Jews' immigration to Palestine on the condition the newly arrived Jews are employed in lands that are not owned by any individual. The declaration was a beginning of efforts in the international arena to establish a so-called State of Israel. It is not an exaggeration if we say that the conditions of the Balfour Declaration became the manifesto of the Israeli cinema. Ben Dob, who was dubbed as a father of the Israeli cinema in collaboration with several other filmmakers in a project called Mirror of the Return of the Israeli People, immediately started making propaganda documentary films. Many of the films were ordered by the Jewish National Fund, an organization that was established in 1901 with the aim of buying land from Palestinians and, in a broader perspective, for the development of Jewish lands in Palestine. These movies also depicted the Arabs of Palestine in the form of primitive people, serfs, and without any national identity, who were wandering about in the desolate and barren desert. The model of the narrative structure of what later became known as the Israeli cinema is the product of that period. This structure narrated history like this. Jewish immigrants took root in an inhabited and abandoned territory, expanded it, and made it prosperous. Movies that announced the discovery of a lost paradise that had no owners. Hence, moviegoers all around the world watched the story of the Zionists like a big luck for the Palestinians. The migration that brought culture and wealth to the quote-unquote miserable land. On the other side of the world, Jewish capitalists who were fleeing the war and had entered the U.S. a little earlier and founded Hollywood started making films from the very first days that completed the narrative of the Zionist cinema. Legendary Hollywood producers, the Warner Brothers, Samuel Goldwyn, and Louis Mayer presented a fixed and dangerous stereotype of the hated Arabs in their movies. Wild and backward people, who soon became the most infamous characters of Hollywood. With the help of the silver screen, the image of the confrontation between educated Jewish immigrants and primitive Arab inhabitants occupied the historical memory of moviegoers all over the world. In the Middle East, Arabs, like many Eastern societies, got to know cinema from the 1920s. In the 1930s, cinema halls were established in all major cities of Palestine. But the way cinema entered the Palestinian society turned into a big issue. Most of the movies that were shown on the silver screens were Egyptian musical comedies. Superficial melodramas that exposed private romantic relationships to the public for the first time. Religious figures, not only in Palestine, but also in Syria, Egypt, and Jordan, constantly asked the authorities to stop the movies or at least censor them. Despite all of this, the cinema seemed insignificant compared to the great problems that Palestinians were dealing with. 10 years had passed since Palestine was Britain's tutelage. At the turn of the 1930s, an influx of Jewish migrants started from everywhere in the world towards Palestine, and the Arabs were slowly realizing that they were being trapped. It was during that period when Palestinian protests in the cities of Al-Quds and Jaffa turned bloody and the British army suppressed the Arab uprisings. Arab leaders showed up claiming they want to resolve the problem of the Palestinian people, but their presence was so ineffective that it was unclear whether they were going there to protect Al-Quds or to say goodbye to it. In 1935, Saudi King Abdulaziz bin Saud went to Al-Quds. The only thing that made this trip different was the presence of a Palestinian with his camera, Ibrahim Hassan Sarhan. Sarhan made a 20-minute movie of the event and started the Palestinian cinema. At that time, Sarhan and a few other passionate filmmakers experienced making movies again, a cinema that has no trace today except for the memories of the people and the notes printed in the newspapers back then. It looked like Palestinian cinema was being shaped, but the storm of events that soon reached Palestine shattered the dreams of the first generation of Palestinian filmmakers. The situation in Palestine worsened with the start of the Second World War. The Zionists were moving Jews from Eastern Europe and America to Palestine in droves. By the end of the war, the Jewish population had increased from 5% at the beginning of the 20th century to 30%. The increase in population coincided with the decline of Britain, which had suffered a huge loss in the heart of the war front. Britain, that once claimed that the sun never sets on the territory of its empire, turned into a toothless lion at the end of the war that was not even capable of protecting its smallest and closest colonies. Now, the maintenance of Palestine required at least 100,000 soldiers.
Part 1A.
The bankrupt and weak British Parliament immediately left the issue of Palestine to the United Nations.
I now declare open the first meeting of the United Nations Palestine Commission.
In 1947, the partition plan of Palestine was approved by the United Nations, and Palestine was divided between the Arabs and the Jews. But it was decided that the Zionists would not have the right to form any government before British forces leave Palestine. It was the golden opportunity the Zionists had been looking for years. From that time on, the Zionist terrorist groups drove the final nail in the coffin of the British Empire with numerous bombings and attacks on British soldiers. We'll be right back. May 14th, 1948, the last British ship had not faded away yet when Ben-Gurion announced the existence of Israel in a speech broadcasted by the media.
From the Jewish homeland, Palestine, and the Jewish Brigade,
the skirmish started. Israel occupied Haifa, and pretty soon the cities of Safa and Acre fell. After the bombardment of Jaffa, Sirhan and his friends left all their movies and videos among the blood and fire and ran away. Finally, on May 15, 1948, Israel attacked Al-Quds. On the same day, the Arab armies entered Palestine. Despite the initial victories, the Arabs eventually retreated on all fronts. With the loss of more lands, the number of displaced persons increased by the day. Finally, after a year of conflict, in May of 1949, the Arab countries that rushed to the rescue of the Palestinians surrendered one after the other. The countries inevitably signed the ceasefire agreement. The signing of the agreements paved the way for the acceptance of the usurped government in the United Nations. When the life of the Palestinian community as a political and social entity came to an end, an absolute silence prevailed, a silence of anger and guilty conscience. Life in the coastal cities almost disappeared, and half of the Palestinian citizens became homeless and refugees. About 900,000 displaced people. For years, the refugee ideology dominated the Palestinian culture. Refugees are always pulled here and there, but remain in a temporary state. Memory and nostalgia are a way to understand the history of Palestine. A repressed memory that moves to the subconscious mind like a mental injury and disrupts the sequence of time. The past replaces the present, and the future finds meaning only in the form of a return to the past, a history that endlessly repeats the past that resembles paradise and its collapse. While the Palestinians were shackled with silence, the new storytellers of the Arab world emerged from Egypt. A group known as the Free Officers stage a coup against King Farouk of Egypt. Mohammed Naguib was in the forefront, but everyone knew that the mastermind was none other than Gamal Abdel Nasser, a person who quickly managed to reach the presidency. In a brave move, Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal. The decree had far-reaching and dramatic consequences. since 1948, Western countries sought to bolster the Israeli regime, and the Suez Canal witnessed the daily traffic of foreign ships and arms. Behind the decree by Nasser, it had many untold stories for the Palestinians. The first dramatic consequence of the brave move happened 3 months later. On October 29th, Israel attacked Egypt and occupied the Sinai Peninsula with the help of French and British forces. The Soviet Union supported Nasser and entered the Egyptian battlefield and stood up against France and England. Finally, Britain and France signed a peace agreement and the Israeli soldiers had to retreat. Thus, Nasser reached the peak of his popularity. He spread his story all over the Arab world. The story of the United Arab Ummah, or nation. For many years, the Arabs had pinned their hopes on Gamal Abdel Nasser, but perhaps most of all, the Palestinian refugees were hopeful about Nasser.